Ephesians chapter 5 this morning. If you need a Bible, raise your hand. If, as Anne was introducing Susan McLean and her daughter, you were asking, where do I know that name from? Calvary Chapel Delta. Where have I heard that before? Maybe at last year's PALS conference up in Olathe. Because Pastor Jared, who stepped in at Calvary Johnson County after Rick Jardine went home to the Lord, Pastor Jared is from Calvary Chapel Delta. Doug McLean is his pastor. Susan is his pastor's wife. And Pastor Doug spoke at last year's PALS conference. So that might be the connection. And I remember I didn't hear the full testimony, but Doug was sharing a little bit about his daughter's story, their family story, and their church family's story. And what stuck with me is he said, she's got a medical condition that a fraction of a percent of people ever have, and then she's got another medical condition that a fraction of a percent of people have, and another one and another one. So if you multiply that fraction by that fraction by that fraction, the chances of her having all of these conditions simultaneously is infinitesimally small. And her testimony is that God's grace and mercy in her life and the way that he has used the situation in her life is that precisely, that specifically, that uniquely, especially perfect. So ladies, I would echo my wife's exhortation. Sign up. You don't have to pay when you sign up. We just need to know that you're planning on coming. And what Pastor Rob said about the youth event today obviously applies to the women's retreat. If money would be the only thing that would keep you from signing up, please sign up. The Lord will make a way. He always, always does. Ephesians 5, when we left off last week, Paul was talking about marriage. We're going to talk about marriage again this week. And I asked for a service, and I'm going to ask again. Robbie and Diane have been married for 46 years. Anybody here have them beat? Barb and Denny, how long? 48. By a nose. Robbie and Diane, if you don't know them, have been serving in Calvary's, originally Robbie back in Calvary Costa Mesa, and I think for the last 46 years, in Kansas and adjacent states, and I don't think that there's a fellowship in our region that hasn't been touched by their ministry. We were grateful for the season they spent with us here in Wichita. For some reason, they felt called back to Calvary Ark City. Probably has nothing to do with the fact that their son is the senior pastor, but we're grateful every time that they can visit. But 46 years, 48 years, what a gift. Marriage really is a gift. But it's more than a gift. It's a privilege and it's a responsibility and it's a ministry. And that's everything Paul was telling us last week as we looked at the end of Ephesians chapter 5. Of course, we parked for 6 weeks in verse 21, Paul exhorting us to submit to one another, to serve one another in the fear of God. And then he goes on to give us an example or an illustration, an opportunity to do just that in marriage. He says, wives, verse 22, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord, for the husband is the head of the wife, is also Christ the head of the church, and the Savior of the body. Therefore, just as the church is subject to Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her, that he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word, that he might present her to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish. So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his own wife loves himself, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church. For we're members of his body, of his flesh and of his bones. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let each one of you in particular so love his own wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. That's where we left off last week, and that's where we're going to stay this week. We said last week as we wrapped up that we'd finish the exposition of the passage. We'd tackled the observation and the interpretation of it. Part two this week, or I guess part three if you want to look at it this way. What's the application? Last week we unpacked the what and the so what. This morning we're going to get to the now what. What do I do with this? How do I stole this from Pastor Ryan. How do I put shoes on it and walk it out of here? In the verses that we just read, Paul dropped a bombshell. Right? He dropped a bombshell a week ago, but really he dropped it 2,000 years ago. It's just still continuing to reverberate throughout the body of Christ. Paul told us in the passage that we just read that marriage is intended to declare the gospel. And that was something that people didn't know. It was a mystery, he said. And we know that a mystery in Scripture, that's a technical term, it refers to something hidden or concealed before Christ that's now revealed, that's now made manifest in Christ. And what is made manifest in Christ and what Paul is drawing our attention to this morning is that marriage is intended by God, given by God, to declare the gospel. Marriage declares the gospel, or at least it does when we love and serve each other the way that Paul just told us to. Marriage declares the gospel when we love and serve each other the way that God always intended for us to. When I love and serve Anne, this is review from last week, but just to get us reoriented to where we left off. When I love and serve Anne the way that Paul just told me, sacrificially and unconditionally, I'm declaring this is how Jesus loves his church, his bride. When I love and serve Anne unconditionally and sacrificially, I'm declaring to God as worship, I'm declaring to the world as witness, this is the love of God, this is the power of Christ in me, loving my wife. And when Anne loves and serves me, not when, as, she always does, as she loves and serves me, she's declaring to God as her worship and to the world as her witness, hey, this is my response to the love of Jesus. This is the Spirit-filled devotion of the bride of Christ. And that puts marriage in a whole different perspective, doesn't it? When we look at it that way, we realize marriage is not just a means, it's not just an avenue or a vehicle through which God blesses us and provides for us. Marriage is a ministry through which we bless God and others by letting the way that we love and serve our spouses declare the gospel. And that's awesome, right? I mean awesome in the true sense of the word. Epic. Awe-inspiring. So much so that Paul feels compelled to end this section the way that he does. Nevertheless, each one of you in particular, you and you and you specifically, love your wives. And wives, love and respect and serve your husbands. Don't just stare. He's saying, don't just be agog at the idea of marriage. Don't stare at it dumbfounded. Don't just sit and meditate on it in amazement that marriage can be a declaration of the gospel. It's a huge idea to be sure. But Paul is saying, don't stop with it being a huge idea. Live that idea. Declare the gospel. Love and serve your partner practically, daily, in reality. Live it. How? How do we do that? Last winter, Ann and I did a marriage retreat at Calvary Norman. Some of you were there. And we talked about this idea. We dug deep into this concept. We looked at chapter 5, verse 21, submit, serve one another in the fear of God. And we asked, what does that look like concretely and specifically in the context of marriage? What are some of the things that a husband and wife that want to declare the gospel in and through their marriage actually do to love and serve each other? Going to share a few thoughts this morning. Going to get practical. And as I do, and we talked about this last week, we're going to look at each of them two different ways. First, what does this idea, this concept, this, I don't know, best practice have to do with unity between husbands and wives? What does this have to do with a marriage that declares the gospel? But then we're going to look at it, what does it have to do with our relationship with Jesus, our bridegroom? And that relationship made possible by the gospel. I think at the retreat in Norman, we talked about 9 or 10 different ideas, practical application steps. We don't have time for that. But I'll send out the notes. A couple of people even asked last week. I'll send out the notes for that conference through Simple Church. If you're not in our church database, our electronic directory, grab Pastor Rob by the front door at the Ask Me table as you leave and get plugged in. But I thought maybe we could tackle 4 of them this morning. Four ideas seemed to be a comfortable number when we were going verse by verse or chapter by chapter through Luke. So we'll try that. Four ideas, 4 best practices for a gospel-declaring marriage applicable to our husbands and wives in this life and to Jesus, our eternal bridegroom. 4. Number 1 out of 4, agree with your spouse. That sounds straightforward, Patrick. What's number 2? No, they stay here with me. I get that it's familiar. I get that it's almost intuitive. Amos 3:3, can two walk together unless they be agreed? Obviously not. But it's surprising how many people don't realize that agreement is the goal. It's surprising how many people continue to believe in marriage that winning, prevailing, dominating is the goal. If I look back on 20 years of marriage counseling and premarital counseling, the marriages that I'd categorize as failures, the marriages that didn't make it, that crashed on the launching pad, that ended in divorce, or the marriages that persist but are just miserable, are by and large the ones in which one or both people refuse to accept the goal was unity and the means to unity was agreement. And look, I get that agreement isn't natural. It's the opposite of natural. Competition is natural. Survival of the fittest, the law of the jungle. Agreement is not natural. It's supernatural. It's natural for us to want to compete. It's natural for us to want to win. It's what our flesh expects. It's what our pride demands, right? I'm right, so logically means that means you're wrong. So just get over yourself, will you, and do it my way. That's how our flesh thinks. And when two people come together as one flesh, the way that we just read, that's a lot of flesh. That's a lot of flesh in one place. That's potentially a lot of pride and competition. I thought Ann and I were going to be the exception to that. I thought we were special. I think a lot of couples do. I was convinced that we were friends for like 10 years before we got married, and we'd worked together on and off really, really well for a lot of that time. We're not going to fight. We're not going to argue. We're not going to bicker. We're way past that. Then I looked in the bathroom counter one morning after she moved in, and there was a tube of Colgate toothpaste. What are you thinking? Good and godly people use Crest. It's a silly example, except that it's not. Because by the time people are old enough to marry, we've got hundreds or maybe thousands of preferences around things like that that are so established and so clear in our mind and have become such habits that we think of them as right and wrong, good and bad. Crest is good. Colgate is evil. And ironically, a lot of those things we didn't decide for ourselves. A lot of those things got passed on to us from our parents. I'm a Crest kid because my parents were Crest parents. A lot of what we think of as normal and good and true and right are legacies of the homes that we grew up in. I'm a Crest kid because my parents were Crest parents. I'm a Vikings fan because my parents were masochists. And it works in the other direction too. It works in the other direction. I vowed to never be a smoker because my mom was a pack-a-day smoker. My dad was a 2-pack-a-day smoker. I vowed at an early age I was going to make different mistakes. But what happens when a Crest kid marries a Colgate kid? What happens when the person who grew up in a house that maybe went out to dinner once every couple months, if it was someone's birthday, marries someone that's used to going out 2 or 3 times a week? What happens when somebody who grew up in a house where extra money means saving marries someone who grew up in a house where extra money means, hey, we can go out and enjoy ourselves? We have a lot of preferences. We have a lot of habits. We have a lot of opportunities to fight. I'm right and you're wrong. I'm smart and you're stupid. Or the other way that this can go is one person capitulates. I don't want to fight, so you're right. I don't want to fight, so fine, use Crest. I don't care. It's gross, but whatever. The thing is that neither fighting nor capitulation really lead to unity. Not real unity, not true unity, not usness. The path that leads to unity is one that doesn't come from flesh, but rather from spirit. The other path, the path that leads to unity is agreement. In marriage, two become one. In marriage, we become, in a very real sense, a new creation. Just as in Christ, we are a new creation. It's not for nothing. Paul says that he's speaking of Christ and the church. Marriage creates a new entity. Marriage gives birth to a brand new us with opportunities to pursue and choose us answers. Hey, what do we think about this? How are we going to do this? You use Crest, I use Colgate. That's great. What do we want to use? And if we're looking for an us answer, it doesn't have to be one of the answers that we brought into the marriage. We can talk about Aquafresh. We can explore Arm & Hammer. What is this Toms of Maine stuff that the cool kids are using? Part of the joy of marriage is the adventure of starting with a blank piece of paper and deciding, prayerfully choosing, hey, what are we going to do about this? What are we going to choose about this? Who are we with reference to this? Whatever this is. What's the us answer? Not the legacy that our parents passed on to us. Not what worked for us in our last marriage. Not our me alone with myself preference. Not even the example from our friend's relationship that we really respect and admire. Us. So how does agreeing, how does pursuing usness, how does that apply to our relationship with Jesus? We said we were going to look at each of these two ways. So we talked about agreeing on the horizontal, but what about on the vertical? I mean, there really isn't the same opportunity to pursue unity in that relationship, is there? I mean, he's Jesus. He's God. Whatever he says goes. It's sort of an enforced unity. Except not really. That's not what Jesus is looking for. Jesus doesn't want reluctant compliance. He doesn't want us to sigh and say, fine, you're God, have it your way. What does he tell us? He wants unity born of love. He says, love God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength. Love him, pursue him, and in so doing come to unity. If you love me, keep my commandments. Out of love, live a life that's aligned with me. Jesus is looking for a unity born of relationship. Yeah, but it's always his way. He always gets what he wants. Really? Psalm 37, verses 4 and 5. I know you know them. Delight yourself in the Lord, and he shall give you what? The desires of your heart. If I delight myself in the Lord, he'll give me the desires of my heart. Commit your way to the Lord. He'll bring it to pass. And I get that delighting myself in the Lord inevitably means that my wishes, wants, desires, priorities are going to move in a Godwardly direction. But still, the point is that God doesn't want to impose his direction on us. He could. If he wanted to, he would. But he doesn't want mindless robots. He doesn't want a relationship with embittered slaves. He wants joyful partners. He wants a relationship in which both of us are actively pursuing unity. So how do we do that? How do we pursue unity in our relationships, whether with our husband or wife or with Jesus, our bridegroom? We get to unity by starting and agreeing that that's the goal. But deciding that marriage is not a competition between your answer and my answer. It's not an arena in which one person wins and another person loses. It's not inevitable that one person will end up happy and the other person disappointed. We start by deciding that marriage isn't a contest between your answer and my answer. It's both of us together fighting and pursuing the best answer. And it's checking in to make sure that the best answer from last week, last month, last year is still the best answer today. Because life changes, people change, circumstances change. How do we learn to pursue us answers? We start by agreeing. That's the goal, and that's point number one, best practice number one. Pursue agreement with your husband, with your wife, with your Lord. To really get to us answers consistently, though, involves more than just deciding that we want to. A goal without a plan is just a wish, right? What's the means? What's the mechanism? It's conversation. It's discussion. It's dialogue. It's asking, and here's point number two, it's asking your partner. It's talking about the decisions that are coming up. What do we think? And pressure testing those answers. Are they real? Am I answering reflexively, out of habit? Am I answering under pressure? Am I answering just to get closure? Or is this a real answer that both of us are bought into? Ask your partner, what do you think? What do we think? Talk about the decisions that are coming up. Discuss them. Talk about the decisions that you've already made and debrief them. How do we think it turned out? Do we want to do anything different next time? Talk about the decisions that you're presently living with. Are they working or are they not? Are we happy? Are we satisfied? Are we frustrated? So what you're saying, Patrick, is communicate. That's deep. That's original. Never heard that before. Pretty new stuff there. I'm saying that, but I'm saying more than that. I'm saying communicate, but I'm also saying plan to communicate and commit to communication. It turns out to be harder than we think. Ann and I learned that the hard way. Because ironically, CJ doesn't want to listen to this. Before we were married, we were both professional communicators. We communicated for a living in different jobs. That's what we did, what we got paid to do. And super ironically, at different parts of our lives, we both got paid to teach communication. Does not mean we did it well. Ironically, it meant that we took it for granted. We assumed, because we were both experts, that we would do it well. And other, you know, we got there our own way, but other people come to the same conclusion. Oh, I've been married before. I know how this works. Oh, my parents had a great marriage. I'll just do what they did. But however we get there, if we go in assuming that we're going to communicate great rather than planning and working at it and intending to, we're going to end up misaligned and a lot of times not even know it. We're going to end up with what I call the sailing to Hawaii problem. You've probably heard this. You leave from San Diego on a boat, you're headed to Hawaii, but unbeknownst to you, your compass has a 1 degree error. So imagine a triangle with just a very, very small 1 degree angle between the two legs of the triangle. Well, the further they get, the more they spread out. That's how triangles work. What does that mean? It means the sooner you detect that error, the easier it is, the less energy, time, distance it takes to collapse that triangle and get back on track. So if you recognize that in a few hours sailing to Hawaii, well, that's nominal, that's negligible, that's nothing. If it's a couple days, well, you're going to have to burn some time, some energy, some gasoline, some diesel, whatever, getting back on track. If you let it go for a week, it's likely you're going to miss Hawaii altogether and you're on your way to Japan. Same thing works with a rocket ship to the moon. 1 degree off in your gyroscope, you miss the moon, you're headed to Mars. But what's the point? What does that look like in a relationship? It means the longer we wait to pursue alignment, the longer we wait to check in and say, hey, are we on the same page? Are we tacking the same course? The more time and energy it's going to take to get back to alignment. If we're too busy when the difference is small, well, it's a minor misunderstanding. I mean, there'll be time later. It'll sort itself out. If we don't catch it when it's small, it's only going to get harder. It's only going to be more energy consumptive as time goes on, which means one of two outcomes. It means that one person finally gets to the point where this is just too much. I can't take this anymore. How can you ignore this? I don't believe you're doing this to me. This is ridiculously unfair. In other words, it gets so obvious to at least one person that they have the conversation, but likely have the conversation badly because they've been living with it for so long. Or, opposite direction, one person just gives up. This is too much. This is too big. It's gone on too long. It's never going to resolve. We're never going to agree. I guess I'm just going to have to live with it. I guess I'm just going to have to resign myself to a life of disappointment. The irony is that in both cases, until there's actually a conversation, there's usually, not always, but usually one person who's increasingly upset, angry, disappointed, frustrated, and another person who's oblivious that there's anything wrong. There's one person who's really upset, and how can you not care? And there's other person who doesn't know there's anything to care about. Turns out it doesn't do any good being an expert communicator if you're not communicating. What's the solution? Schedule time to talk. Schedule time, find a time, set aside a time, protect a time in a quiet place where that's what you're there to do. To talk about how are things going? What's happening and what do you think about it? What happened and how do you feel about it? What's coming up? What do we need to decide? What are the us answers that we need to evaluate or choose? And when we've done that, what we've found, and I say we, me, and Ann, but I also say we, a lot of couples that we've counseled over the years, it really helps to schedule it every week. If the key to reaching Hawaii is frequent course corrections to make sure we don't get too far apart, and the key to staying on course is catching that misalignment as quickly as possible, then blocking time for a weekly compass check in your marriage is a game changer. Weekly asking, are we on course? Are we tracking? Are there obstacles ahead? Is there any drift occurring? Are there any obstacles looming? So once a week, Ann and I will typically lunch Monday. We'll talk about our schedule. We'll compare calendars. We'll look at all things financial, budget and spending and big ticket items that are coming up. Practical, house, car, clothes, medical. That's a bigger bucket than it used to be. Relational, our relationship and our relationship together with others. Spiritual, what's God showing you? What's God been speaking to you? Ministerial, what do you need to know about my ministry? And additional, hey, what do we need to talk about that doesn't fit into any of our categories? And again, I'll send our weekly check-in out over email. But the thing about it that helps me and Ann specifically, and here I really am talking about us, but maybe not just us, it takes a lot of the tension out of the conversation. Neither Ann or I love conflict. We're both smart enough to know that conflict is good, and without healthy conflict, sooner or later we're going to make a bad decision with a lot of confidence. So we know that healthy conflict is good. We still don't like it very much. And so for us, there's always the, should I bring this up? Is it really a big deal? Is this a good time? Is he going to get really frustrated? Maybe it's just me. Maybe I don't need to talk about this. Having a weekly state of the state meeting where we don't talk about anything because it's a crisis and it's gotten to the point where I've stood all I can stand and I can't stand no more and all of the lights on my paddle are blinking red. No, we're talking about it because it's Monday. And Monday's when we talk about stuff. It lowers the temperature. It doesn't mean, okay, things have now risen to a crisis point where we have to talk about it. No. If we're doing it right, we're talking about things way before they reach crisis point and we like that. And if life and ministry happen and we can't talk on a particular Monday, we reschedule, we plan, we put it on the calendar because we know ourselves well enough to know it's not going to reoccur spontaneously. And we won't meet again until it's too late, until we see Japan looming large in front of us because we've missed Hawaii because the difference was too big. Strength overplayed is a weakness, and we've learned the hard way. We're both capable, competent people most of the time. We can both navigate life independently for a good long while. If we're not being intentional, we can end up roommates. We can end up living parallel lives instead of lives devoted to loving and serving one another and declaring the gospel. How does this apply to our relationship with Jesus? Sadly, for a lot of us, it's straightforward, isn't it? Because we know that we can go for days, weeks, longer without talking to God. We know that the way that we're going will deviate and deviate and deviate, and our separation from God will grow and grow and grow until we're frustrated or disappointed or angry or desperate enough to cry out to God. And then we go to God, but when we go to God in that place, the only thing we want to talk about is how angry or desperate or frustrated or disappointed we are. What would it take to enjoy real unity with Jesus, our bridegroom? What if we checked in daily? What if we checked in more than daily? But let's start with daily. What if we had a real conversation with Jesus every single day? A conversation where there's talking and listening. A conversation where we're asking, where are we on the same page, Jesus? Where are we not on the same page? What do I need to do to get on the same page? Where am I not realizing there's even a page? What if we regularly had that conversation? God, here's my life. Here are all the areas of my life. Financial, vocational, relational, medical. Am I doing the right things the right way? Are we doing them together? God, here's where I'm feeling out of alignment. Here's where I'm frustrated and confused. Can you help me understand? Can you help me find some peace? Can you help me get back to unity? My strong suggestion is daily. And my strong suggestion is when life intrudes on the time that you've set aside to spend with the Lord, reschedule it immediately. Do not fall into living parallel lives with God. Which brings us to another habit. This is number three. Number one was agree. Number two was ask. Number three is prioritize. And I get that that sounds a little redundant because what I just essentially said was ask and make it a priority to ask. Another way of putting that, that'll be familiar to folks who have done premarital with us, is I've said make that conversation, make that daily conversation with God, that weekly or more often, you do you, but that weekly conversation with your spouse, make that a big rock. What do you mean big rock? It's my favorite sermon illustration. And I think I've used this from the pulpit. I know that I've used this at retreats or at father-child weekends. And I've done it live. I've put a 50-gallon aquarium on a table on the platform and put in a couple, three big basketball-sized, beach ball-sized rocks that fill that aquarium wall to wall. And I'll ask the room, is the aquarium full? Well, you're not going to put another rock in there. But is it full? No, because I'll reach down and pick up a sack of landscaping rocks, you know, the ones about the size of your thumb that you put around trees or around bushes or stuff. You can put a whole lot of those between those small boulders. Is it full now? Turns out no, because I can pick up some really fine white sand, the kind of sand that you might put in paint to texturize something, and the sand will fall between the rocks that are between the boulders. And I'll ask again, is it full? And people won't answer because they know I've messed with them twice already. Pick up a big old bucket of water, pour that on top because the water will fit between the sand, it'll fit between the pebbles, that'll fit between the boulders. And then the question, what's the moral of the story? And the answer that I always get without fail, because we're Americans, there's always room for a little more. The real moral of the story is if you don't put those big rocks in first, they're never going to fit. We tell ourselves that the important discussions, those check-in discussions with God and with our spouse, will happen when they happen. They'll fit in and around the other things. They're the water. They'll just ooze wherever there's space. Because we're with our spouses every day. We're with God even more so. He's everywhere all the time. So we'll just catch up whenever we have a spare moment. How well does that work? Letting those conversations be the water that'll just flow between the cracks. Even if it works, which usually it doesn't, it's not a good conversation. It's not a deep conversation. It's not a unity conversation because we're distracted and time pressured and moving ahead to the next rock or the next boulder. On-the-fly conversations are necessary and helpful, don't get me wrong. Those arrow prayers that we see places like Elijah, God help! Those are utterly, utterly important. But they're not enough to achieve true unity. They're not enough to help our marriages declare the gospel. So when we talk about prioritizing someone, someone our husband and wife, someone our bridegroom Jesus, that means making that relationship and the communication necessary for unity in that relationship a big rock. It goes in first, and other stuff gets organized around it. We need to make actively pursuing unity a priority and schedule it like we schedule anything else important, because there's nothing more important. Trying to fit it in around the busyness of school and job and work and life and family and ministry, it's just never going to happen. But when we're talking about prioritizing our partners, we're talking about something else as well. Because you're right, that part was a little redundant. But there's another aspect to prioritizing our partners. It's letting them cut in line. Awkward to tell a story about my daughter when she's in the room, but I'm going to do it anyway. Because she was like 2 and she was barely sentient and she was running around the house. And she fell down and she ripped her forehead open on a piece of furniture. And Ann called the church. And my friend Jen answered the phone, and Ann said, "Hey, so here's the thing. Michaela fell and sliced her forehead open. I need to take her to the hospital. I can't drive a car and hold pressure on her bleeding scalp wound at the same time. Patrick's probably too busy. Is there any way that you could send an intern over to the house to either drive or hold pressure? Either one is good, but I can't do both." So Jen tracks me down and she finds me. She's white as a ghost. She's like, "Ann and Michaela and blood. And you need to, and blood." Anne was first of all surprised that I showed up. She was honestly, you can ask her, she was stunned that I didn't send an intern. And the point of the story is that I was doing a really bad job of prioritizing my wife. I would have told you, of course she's my priority. If you had asked me, if you had given me that fact pattern and presented it to me in the abstract, I would have said, of course I'm going to go home. But Anne didn't know that. She didn't believe that. She was fully expecting something other than that, which meant that practically I wasn't prioritizing my wife because she didn't know it. Prioritizing our partner means regularly scheduled conversations. That is preventative maintenance. But it also means reactive maintenance. It also means being able to push the big red button that stops everything. That says something else needs to move to the front of the line and it needs to happen now. How do you do that with your spouse? How do you cut in line? How do you push the big red button? Things that Ann and I have figured out about us, if I text Ann, she might not see it until Tuesday. If I call her, I almost never do, so that must mean that it's important. If Ann reaches out to me, she knows that if it's important, the first thing that she needs to say is, "I need help." Ann has a tendency to start at the beginning of a story and work her way to the end. And so, hey, Michaela was running around. Well, not running around exactly, but she was playing. You know the way the kids play. And she was in the kitchen and she was in the dining room. I think she was downstairs for a while, but then she was up in the bedroom. And then she fell down. I think she fell down more than once, but there was one time where she fell down that she cut her head. And she's bleeding, and I could really use your help going to the hospital. That's how Anne tells a story, but she buries the lead. So for me, pushing the big red button is saying up front. So at the end of the story, I'll tell you how we got here, but the bottom line is I need help. So maybe you can start driving now and I'll tell you the story while you're on your way. That's us. You do you. But if you don't have a reliable way of doing that for each other, if you don't have a way that you know works, that you've agreed to interrupt each other, to cut in line, to ask for help with the expectation that you're actually going to get it, if you don't have that, are you really prioritizing each other? And then the next question, are we giving God a reliable way to interrupt us? Are we giving God a reliable way to intrude on our day, to cut into the front of the line, to push the red button, to give us help we don't know we need? It's not a perfect parallel, but it ends up in the same place. Does God have permission to intrude in your life, in my life? Does God have permission to interrupt our day? He's God. He can do whatever he wants. Yeah, I know. But we already observed this morning, God's gracious. And he tends not to shake us or shout at us until he's tried whispering and tapping us on the shoulder. Hey, I got something that you need to see. Are we listening for his still small voice? Are we sensitive to his gentle tap? Hey, I need a minute. hey, we really need to talk. And when God does shake us, when he does shout at us, when we don't listen to his still small voice, so he uses life and people and circumstances to dramatically interrupt us, what's our response? If our response to an interruption in our day, in our routine, in our lives is from our flesh, I hate this, this isn't the day that I planned, everything is going wrong, wrong! If I react in the flesh, well then God's voice is only going to get fainter. My perception of his gentle taps on my shoulder is only going to get weaker. But if I respond in the spirit, okay, this is not the day I had planned, God. What are we doing? This isn't what I expected. How are we going to handle this? How are we going to handle this, Lord? If I say, Lord, I need a fresh filling of whatever it is, of your spirit, for whatever it is that's happening here, well, then my perception of his voice is only going to get stronger. Does God have permission to interrupt us? Have we given him permission to wreck our day? Are we giving him permission day over day to call time out, to cut in line, to say, I really need you to pay attention to me right now? And that's a mindset we can cultivate. God, here's what I think we're doing. I've prayed, we've talked about this. I think we're on the same page. If not, will you tell me? Will you show me? Will you shut the door? Because I don't want to go anywhere that you're not with me. I don't want to go anywhere that we're not in unity. If I hold my plans, if I hold my goals, my dreams, my expectations, all in an open hand, it's easier for God to take and set something aside and replace it with something better. If I grip my plans tightly, it's a lot harder, and it hurts a lot more when God has to pry them out of my grasp, which he will, because the thing about God, the things that makes him God, is he always prioritizes us. Ask, agree, prioritize. One more. Learn. Hinted at that one a moment ago when I talked about how Anne tends to communicate. When she's talking about something, when she's telling a story, a lot of you know her and you know this about her. She starts at the beginning and she tells the story through to the end. A, B, C, D, E, F. Oh, the alphabet. Not done yet. G, H, I, J. Okay, you're headed to Z. Okay, now I have to start over. A, B, C. That's how she thinks, and it's how she communicates. Detail, 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 conclusion. I go the other way. I start to tend to start a conclusion, tend to start a big idea. Hey, it's the alphabet. You get vowels, you get consonants. If people want more detail, you know, it's ABC and all of that. I start big and work down to small. You know, the right way. Joking. But joking in order to make a serious point, Anne and I process information really differently. I go big concept to small detail, Anne goes small details and builds the big concept. One isn't right or wrong, one isn't better or worse, but they're really different because we're different. And if I don't learn those differences and pay attention to them, I'm not going to love Anne as well as I could, as well as I should. Odds are you and your spouse have differences as well, maybe differences like that, maybe other differences. Not for nothing, God uses the word helpmate to help in an area that's not your native strength. Maybe you and your spouse process information differently. Maybe you make decisions differently. Anne likes making decisions. She comes to a fork in the road, she takes it. I come to a fork in the road, I stare at it. Anne likes making decisions. Sitting in options is stressful. I like options. I'll make a decision when I need to, but why would anybody make a decision before they need to? Just another example of how we can balance each other if we know each other, if we've learned each other, and if we look at the ways in which we're different as strengths, not defects. If we look at our differences as opportunities that we can help each other and not glaring evidence that someone needs to fix them. It's not about right and wrong. It's about love. And love is about others. And I can't love someone really well unless I know them, unless I've learned them, and unless I value what I've learned about them. If I don't learn Anne and if I don't appreciate the ways in which we're different, when I try to love her, I'm going to naturally give the way that I like to get. I'll start with conclusions because that's what I want. She wants detail. I'll provide lots and lots of options because that's what I want. She'd rather just have two and ideally which one I prefer. I tend to show love with physical touch because that's how I like to receive love and would much rather have the gift of time. When there's something going on, I'd like to sit and talk because that's my comfort zone and would almost always rather walk and talk. We're getting better at it, though. I tell you, early in our relationship, vacationing together was super stressful because we knew each other in a work context. We didn't know about how we like to relax. So we'd go on vacation, we'd come home completely exhausted from striving and contending and arguing about what rest was supposed to look like. How's that for ironic? But you know, last November was our 25th anniversary. We saved up and we took a trip to Hawaii, and it was fantastic because 25 years later, we took everything that we'd learned about each other and we applied that to outdoing one another in love. We figured out along the way that vacation meant rest. It didn't mean it was all about me. Shocking, right? So Anne would say, well, okay, look, you want time to read. And I'd say, yeah, but we need to build in time for you to go on adventures. And she'd say, you want to eat fish that's so fresh it's still bouncing. And I'd say, yeah, but eating out all the time is stressful for you. And I'd say, you want to go on hikes? And she'd say, okay, but we need options in case your knee gets crabby. And we ended up with an us vacation because we took what we had learned about each other and we used it to love each other. Do we need to learn God the same way? Of course we do. The analogy breaks down a little bit because there's nothing for God to learn about us. But the better we understand Him, the more we know how to love Him, and the better we understand His love for us, the more we're able to recognize and value His love for us. Conversations I've had with people literally this week. Hey, did you know God's not in a hurry? That was a big idea for someone this week, and it's an important one. To realize that if God's not answering, it doesn't mean that He doesn't have the answer. It means He's waiting for the best time to reveal the best answer. If we haven't learned that about God, we might not recognize His love, and we might think that if He hasn't answered, He doesn't care. Things that people have talked to me about this week. Did you know God uses pain to grow us? Yeah. Sometimes He ordains it, sometimes He allows it, sometimes the pain is just the result of our dopey choices. But whatever the ultimate source, God always uses it. He never wastes it. Why? Because love requires it. Really? Yeah, God chastens those He loves. And those that God would use greatly, He must first wound deeply. Because without wounds, without pain, how well can we really understand Jesus? But if I don't know that about God, if I haven't learned that about God, I might assume pain in my life means that He doesn't love me and that God is capricious and arbitrary at best, spiteful and mean at worst. Except God does love us. And He loves us not by doing what we think is best, but by doing what He knows is best. He loves us not by giving us what we want, but what He knows we need. If I don't know that about God, if I haven't learned that about God, if I forget that about God, then the only blessings I'm going to recognize are the ones that I specifically, precisely asked for. And I'm going to miss entirely the blessings that are greater than I asked for. If I haven't learned what the love of God is like, I'm going to hear Him say no, or I'm going to watch Him say no, and I'm going to stop paying attention because all I heard was no. And I'm going to walk away convinced that God is mean because I'm going to miss the part where He says, no, I've got something better. I'm going to miss the part where His answer to my prayer is, no, you're not thinking big enough. I want to bless you more. But if I learn God, I spend less time frustrated. I spend less time saying, I don't understand. Why are you like this, God? And more time believing and seeing He always loves me the very best ways. How do we learn God? How did you learn your spouse, if you have? By paying attention. By spending time, by studying. What does God say in His Word? What are the words that He speaks? What are the ways that He answers in prayer? I think keeping a prayer journal is such a wonderful discipline. How has God answered my prayers? You can get a glimpse into God's character through biographies. How has God moved in the life of Christian men and women? Being in part of a small group and watching in real time as God's love plays out in the different lives of the people in that group, or even with one partner. a prayer partner, an accountability partner, somebody who will keep your eye on your relationship with God, who will ask you what's going on in your relationship with God. One of the most important conversations I've had in the last 4 years, when I started dealing with long-haul COVID and was griping to my doctor about it, believer, he said to me, okay, but what is God teaching you through this? What is he showing you? What have you learned so far? Nothing, because my attention was on me and I was quite busy feeling sorry for myself. But that's the adventure. As we wrap up, we've looked at it from four angles: agreeing, asking, prioritizing, learning. They're all means to the same end. Whether we're talking about husbands and wives or talking about our eternal bridegroom Jesus, we're talking about ministry. We're talking about loving and serving with a goal of unity. We're talking about lives knit together, writing testimony, declaring the gospel as worship and witness. Like I said, I'll send out notes for the things we didn't get to. If you're not an internet person, talk to Pastor Rob. We'll get a printout. But for now, I want to end in prayer, and then we'll worship. Lord, I bring before you the married couples in this room, the married couples watching online, the married couples within the sound of my voice. Maybe someone is watching or listening to this weeks or months from now. But Lord, you know each couple, each relationship. You know the plans that you have for it. And whatever other plans that you have called each marriage to declare the gospel. Lord, would you do the things necessary in our hearts and in our lives to make that possible, to make that more than possible, to make that real, to bring that forth. Lord, would you ordain conversations? Would you open our eyes to differences? Would you engineer true unity, unity born of your Spirit? That the love and ministry that we lavish on one another would shout, this is the love of Jesus, and this is my love in response to the love of Jesus. Lord, I pray for marriages that are struggling. I pray for marriages that might be surrendering, giving up. Lord, would you bring revival? Would you speak truth? Would you speak hope into their lives? Would you bring people into their lives to minister to them, to counsel them, to encourage them, to point them to you? And Lord, I pray for singles. People who have always been single, people who are single again, people who are on the other side of divorce, widows or widowers. A day talking about marriage can dredge up a lot of thoughts and feelings. Lord, would you cut through the chaos of our minds, our emotions, and would you minister truth? That whatever our human relationships are or aren't, you are our Father and you are our bridegroom, and nothing can change that. That is an eternal relationship. We are sealed by your Spirit. We have your promise. Lord, would you redeem the days of singleness? You tell us in your word that to be single is to be wholly devoted to you, to not have our affection or our devotion divided between you and family. And so, Father, would you speak with clarity to each single? What is their ministry for this season? They're sanctified and set apart for you, whether for a time or a lifetime. Lord, what do you have? What is the next thing? And the thing after that and the thing after that, reveal them, Lord, in your timing. But Lord, in the midst of that, would you minister peace? Would you minister assurance that you are there and you are enough? And Lord, would you be enough in all of the ways that our souls long for? We thank you, Lord, for marriage. We thank you, Lord, for singles. And we look forward to seeing what you're going to do in and through all of us as we pursue relationship with Jesus, our bridegroom.